everyone. Welcome to the MRP Tech Podcast. This is episode 95. My name is Matt, and this is the weekly podcast discussing everyday tech for everyday people. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Before we get into that, just want to plug a few things. If you've never listened to the shows on Podnuts before, you can go to podnuts.com. Check out all the great shows over there. If you'd like more information on the things that I do, you can go over to mrptechreviews.com and all the great information there as well. We are gearing up as I mentioned, 95 episodes in. We got about five more episodes. We're hitting episode 100. We're going to do a big live celebration with that. We're inviting lots of guests on to that show. And we also have that Discord chat server all set up. Tonight is sort of an experiment. So we're streaming live to see if it works. And for the very first time, without the safety of a net, the death-defying stunt, I have my first interview of the podcast, and I have a great guest with me tonight. And I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, an esteemed colleague, and an absolute genius in a lot of different topics. I just want to introduce to you, here's Emmett Hoops. Emmett, say hello to everybody.
Well, hello, everybody. I don't know if I qualify for all that, but thanks.
So Emmett is, just to give you guys a heads up, I won't give away too much information, but Emmett and I work together at the school district. He is a technology coordinator at the school that we work at. He is has been a longtime Linux user, just like I have been using Linux for a really long time. Not only that, he's a big fan of really old school big band music, which I talk about occasionally on here. Ham radio advocate, and loves to talk about ham radio. And also with that, our wives even have the same name. So how cool is that? So so we got a lot in common. We got a lot of great things to talk about tonight. So first of all, I guess let's get right into it. Let's talk about the technology coordinator position that you have. How long have you been technology coordinator at school?
Well, actually, that was one of the first things I got into there, because at a previous school where I was in 1993, we were the first school in Northern New York to start using the internet on a regular basis in the classroom. And it was all through this little thing called the math problem of the week, which was all on a, done with dial-up connection, wires strung from an office 300 feet away and things like that. It was kind of neat. Then when I got to Mariah, that was 1998, actually.
1998,
wow. Yep, when I was named the technology coordinator.
Now, was there a coordinator before that, or was that just something that you were interested in technology stuff and you volunteered for?
Well, the position didn't exist before, but the superintendent at the time said we need to have somebody we can designate as a technology coordinator because we have to have one for the state was requiring districts to implement technology plans and have them approved several years out. So there had to be a contact person who was the technology coordinator at the school. So
gotcha. So
I got that title.
And from what I remember, I think I remember you telling me a story. You actually installed one of the first servers at the school. Is that right?
It was the first server at the school, and it had a whopping big 18.2 gigabyte hard drive. How do you like that?
18.2, huh?
That's I also, I thought I was a genius. You know, we had fewer than one computer per classroom at the time, but I managed to map every room to their own little drive, so everybody could save their stuff to this massively big hard drive.
I bet it was a lot more difficult back then.
Well, it certainly, there was no Active Directory, you know.
Yeah.
It was all done on NT, which was a very stable operating system.
Yeah.
I kinda missed Windows NT.
You know, I was just I was just talking to a IT guy. He actually runs IT for a lot of the local banks recently, and we had a conversation about NT and those operating systems from that time period, like, you know, how stable XP was for so long. And it actually was kind of funny because Windows XP almost saved the day the other day over the weekend. But we won't get into that story today. So let's talk about some projects that you've done at school, or some grants that you've written, and how you've gotten the school to where it is today. Because it's, you know, it's a pretty neat school to work in, and it's got a lot of great things happening. And just because somebody's taken the lead with it.
Well, there are two things I'm most proud of, and one is the getting the distance learning lab in. That was something that I just felt, because I had the good fortune to go to school at a very large high school in Brooklyn, and essentially it was like going to a small college. We got to choose our own course of study, as long as it was within certain parameters. And my school was from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it allowed me to choose foreign languages, European history, the Bible as literature, Shakespeare, all of these different things that you couldn't get in the regular course of study. And I thought, if I were in a small district like the one in which I teach, I really, really, really would be so intellectually starved if I didn't have some other way of getting out of the small environment and getting into the larger schools. And that's what we do. We have kids taking AP history and things like that that they couldn't do in our district. So there was that. And the thing that you probably wouldn't find this at all interesting, but I got the elementary school to adopt a standards-based plan book and report system.
And so that, do you remember the name of that?
Yeah, it's called Teacher Ease.
Teacher Ease. And right. And so that's a grading book program for all the elementary grades?
It's a you can keep your plans in it. You can make the students can take online assessments with multimedia tests, which are actually very easy to make. So if you're teaching with pictures in the lower grades, you can make tests with pictures, things like that. And the scores are automatically, you identify the standard that you're addressing in your test, and the scores are automatically parsed out to the various parts of your grade book so that you don't have to manually input the grades, which is quite nice.
That's kind of cool. And so, yeah. So where in this process did Linux come into play? When did you start using Linux?
Well, early on, when I realized how much all this stuff was costing, my massive 18.2 gigabyte server was over $4,000, for instance. Wow. I realized that the licenses for Windows NT and the licenses for all of these computers we were going to have to pay for Microsoft Windows, and we were going to have to pay license fees for Office, and for all of these different programs that we wanted to run, had to get site licenses. And then I realized, well, there's got to be an easier way, and open source seemed to be the best way to go. We could have an open source software. At the time, there was an alternative to Microsoft Office called OpenOffice, that's now LibreOffice, which is one of my favorite.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of LibreOffice. That sounds kind of similar to my story, because when I sort of got involved with Linux, I was basically just out of grad school, and I was looking into things like Microsoft Office and things like Photoshop and some really expensive music notation software. And right. Of course, each one of these, you know, it's $300 for this and $600 for that. And so I then all of a sudden I found GIMP, and I was blown away, you know, that you could have a quality program that was close in some respect to the Photoshop, you know, maybe not exactly the same, but at the same time it was free and you could get it. And so then all of a sudden I stumbled by accident, sort of speak. I was thinking, well, if there's a free open source software, there must be I wonder if there's an open source operating system. And then that started me down the whole path that I'm still on today. So when you first started Linux, what was the first Linux distro you sort of started getting into?
It was Dapper Drake.
Dapper Drake.
Dapper Drake.
Was that a Mandrake fork?
Nope, or? that's Ubuntu 6.0.
Gotcha, 6.0. Okay.
Yes, you know it's Ubuntu if you have alliteration.
Yeah, I wasn't ready for that. I was thinking it was going to be Mandrake just because I heard somebody tell me earlier today that they used Mandrake back in the day. And so I heard right. Drake and I thought Mandrake, but I started...
Well, I mean, I heard that the European Union was back, I don't know when, around 2002, the European Union was dumping Windows and was going with Linux in their government servers. And I said, well, if the whole government can do it, at least the school district can try it.
Isn't that incredible? That's pretty yeah. awesome. So after Dapper Drake, did you stick with Ubuntu or what are you running now?
I stuck with Ubuntu for a long time until they moved their main interface to Unity, which I could not tolerate. And I looked around for some alternative that was close to Ubuntu, but did not use Unity. And lo and behold, you know what system is the only one that answers to that. Yeah, and that's Linux Mint.
Linux Mint. I had a feeling you were going to say that. So it was all just solely based off the Unity desktop. And have you ever tried any of the Ubuntu flavors, like Kubuntu or Ubuntu Mate or anything like that?
I have. I've tried Kubuntu. I tried Zubuntu, which is, for low RAM things. Yep. And I found... all of the other ones, I'm not sure if it was just the computer that I was using, which was not a high-powered thing, was just a cheap little Lenovo laptop. I found that Kubuntu in particular was very buggy,
yeah.
Although I have to say I didn't use it past version 12.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. Obviously, we're on 18.04 right now, and we actually have Diveer in the chat room. He said he started using Linux with Red Hat Linux 2.0 back in 1995. That goes way back. So that's a lot of people really like the Ubuntu alternatives. I stuck with Unity for a while, and I wanted, that was something that I wanted to love. It was different, I thought. It was very creative, and I thought originally it came from, I think, the Ubuntu Netbook Remix and made for netbooks, and then all of a sudden they got into the whole convergence idea where they wanted the one operating system for their phones and tablets and laptops and desktops too, and I think they kind of went down the wrong path there, and that's Unity took a turn for the worse, so to speak. And so I think they tried it as long as they could, but recently they just went back to the GNOME desktop, and I actually was testing it out in a virtual machine, and it's actually quite nice. GNOME seems to always have been sort of the desktop for me. I really enjoy GNOME. I don't know if you've taken a look at the most recent release of Ubuntu, but definitely take a look at it.
I will. Well, just last thing there on poor little Ubuntu's Unity. I could see that they were looking to, get some kind of new interface and it was all heading toward mobile phones. And I felt like hollering out, hey, Canonical, let's get real. You're just not going to have success with phones. Everybody else has already been there and done that.
Well, at the same time, even Microsoft has tried it, and they're pretty much ditching, Windows
yep,
Mobile.
They are.
So, I mean, even the biggest company in the world hasn't been able to make this successful. So, it was a worth a shot, I guess. But at the same time, they should have spent their time, maybe giving back to local other projects or something like that to make their operating system or desktop experience better. And speaking of projects, do you have any favorite open source projects that you software that you use quite a bit?
Well, believe it or not, SchoolTool is an awfully good open source project. In many cases, a lot of districts aren't aware that it's open source, and their local board of cooperative educational services typically charges a fee for it, as if they came up with it or bought it from Microsoft.
Yeah, so.
It's bizarre. You could have your own server, and it's very simple to operate, but almost no school does.
So those of you who are listening that don't know what SchoolTool is, SchoolTool is basically an all-inclusive piece of software that you can do your grading for your classrooms. You can create seating charts. You can submit data for report cards, and you can contact parents, and parents can go in and see messages from teachers. It's a really great piece of software. It's actually made by Canonical, if I'm right. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
So I mean, it's open source, but what happens is a lot of IT companies come in and they put their branding on it, and they may lock down some services that would actually be useful or that type of thing. So that's where it sort of takes its turn, you know. And so any other projects that you have an interest in?
I like Moodle, which is also a lot of the functions of Moodle have been duplicated in Google Classroom. I think that's what Google Classroom was looking at. Not enough people were using Moodle because you pretty much have to have your own server. I like Stellarium, and LibreOffice is always one of my favorites. And one of the reasons I love Linux is you get into the package manager and look at all the opportunities you have for free programs to operate digital ham radio.
Yeah, and
the things you can't pronounce, like full digi.
The thing that I wanted to ask you about, we were talking right before the show started, and we were sort of testing out our equipment. So to give you kind of an example, the guy that runs Podnuts, he goes by the name Door to Door Geek, and he's well known for listening to record amounts of podcasts in a day. He will listen to podcasts at three times the speed of a normal podcast, and he'll get through like 48 hours worth of podcasts, or 24 or 48, I can't remember, hours in a day of podcasts. And so we wanted to, you know, he loves listening to podcasts. He'll support all local podcast artists, and he'll be able to he's helpful in so many podcasters out there. And so we want to talk about your favorite podcast, if you just got a few of them that you want to listen to.
Podcasts. Okay, well, this is where the oddball part of me comes out. I like to listen to radio plays because of my interest in German as a language. A lot of European countries never gave up on radio as an entertainment medium. So you can go to Germany or listen to the BBC, and there is a fairly large audience still for radio drama. And we don't have that in the United States, but we do have a lot of radio dramas from the 40s and 50s that were recorded with fairly high audio quality.
Any favorites in mind that you...
Oh boy, I love my Johnny Dollar. Yes, America's favorite expense account.
I've never heard of it. I might have to check that out.
So Johnny Dollar is great. And then there's Suspense was a show that was on CBS from 1942 to 1962.
So sounds like you're a big fan of older radio programs that are now released in like sort of podcast format.
Yep, and I listen to Deutsche Welle, the German service. They put out they make some podcasts available. A lot of German podcasts are almost toward horror, but there's a lot of good drama that comes out of Germany.
So we probably should.
A lot of serialized things come out of BBC as well.
So we probably should bring up that you know quite a few different languages, German being one of them, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, as far as a fluency, it's certainly there in German. Russian, I have an ability to read French and Italian. But because I have no one to speak to, if you don't speak a language, it becomes difficult to start it up again. It takes weeks, actually, with a language that you've been away from.
I believe it.
Speaking for years. And
what got you interested in all these different languages? Do you have family, or do you have
ancestry? Go figure. I remember when I was in the fourth grade having my head slapped because I had a little book called Instant German. I was trying to memorize these little German phrases, and I was 9 years old then, and I have to look and say, well what? Nobody in my family spoke German. I have no idea why I was interested.
One of those things.
Yeah, it's like what Duke Ellington said about music. If it sounds good, it is good.
That's for sure.
And,
that's
really, and I've always liked the sound of German.
So German, Russian, Italian, French, anything else?
I don't know. I'm meandering around in Mandarin.
I got you. So that's, yeah. You also know Morse code too, right?
Oh yeah. I can pretty much do send and receive at 18 words a minute, but any faster than that, and I break out into a sweat.
I break out in a sweat just saying the words Morse code. So I've tried a few times to get into it, and I'm just not there yet, but at some point I probably will get into it.
Yeah, it's fun. But, you know, languages, it's one of those things. If you learn a language, you open up a whole new library to you, because there's no such thing as translation. There's only approximation.
That's absolutely
right. So if you like reading, you might as well learn at least another language.
You know, I sort of kicked myself, because when I was in high school, I never took French very seriously. And now I'm a supervisor at a local tourist attraction in the summertime. And of course, we have a lot of Canadians that come, and most of them, their English is broken, and they don't understand. They can't read the signs. And so I'm kicking myself now, and I wish I would be able to communicate with them better and you know, talk about things that I'm interested in the area, and it's just not there. But every once in a while, I'm a subscriber to Audible, and every once in a while I think about getting some audiobooks and learning French again, because I was halfway decent at it in college, but
yeah, it would be great. I mean, schools don't take it too seriously.
No.
I mean, we take it for granted that everybody speaks our language, but imagine if we were born in Estonia.
Right.
You know, there's more people live in Brooklyn than live in Estonia.
Yeah.
And it would be pretty tough getting around the world if you expected everybody to speak Estonian.
So, yeah. And speaking of around the world, you know, around the world, a lot of people speak English. One of your favorite hobbies is amateur radio. We've talked about amateur radio quite a bit off the air. But how did you get interested in amateur radio? Because amateur radio seems to go sort of hand in hand with Linux. Everybody that I know that's into amateur radio is sort of into Linux too. So.
Yes, well, it's what you get when you graduate in the school of nerddom.
That's right.
You get a ham radio license. I grew up in a family that we didn't watch too much television. We sat around and listened to the radio. My parents loved listening to Gene Shepherd, who was one of the last, last of his kind. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
No, I haven't.
And we listened. Yeah, Bob and Ray had a show on in the mid-1970s. They were on WOR New York, and that was a comedy show. And they used to parody some of the old radio shows. And, I used to look at this radio that was in the kitchen, and it said SW in between FM and AM. And I asked my father one day, what's SW? He said, that's shortwave. So I said, well, how do we listen to things on that? So he took a piece of copper wire, stuck it into the back of the radio, and ran it out to the pole in the backyard. And we didn't, it was just some kind of antenna, random length. And we started listening to Radio Tirana, Albania.
Wow.
Radio Sofia, Bulgaria. Radio Prague, Czechoslovakia. Radio Moscow. Radio Peking. Radio Hanoi. Radio Deutsche Welle. The BBC, Radio South Africa, the voice of South Africa.
And all from that one line running out.
Oh, it was amazing. It was like the whole world was coming into our kitchen.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, we all sat around listening to Radio Moscow. It was funny. We would, because, and I would write letters to these places, and they'd read my letters. And it was, wow. All the way around the world, somebody saying Emmett Hoops of Brooklyn, New York, right?
That's really cool. I guess what blows my mind is I never realized that all this stuff was out there until I got into amateur radio. Many people actually had a listener a long time ago write into the show and talk about shortwave radio. And a lot of people had a passion for it, especially in the 80s.
That's gone, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. And a lot of people think that radio is dying, and especially just listening to radio in the car. I mean, most people are listening to podcasts and that type of stuff. It's kind of sad to see all that stuff go. But it's
certainly changing.
It is changing. I don't think it'll ever go away.
There's a lot of loud broadcasters still on shortwave, but there are a lot of translators as well. Like, instead of like Radio Romania International actually broadcasts from somewhere in South Carolina. So, I mean, which would have been impossible during the Cold War. But
speaking of the Cold War, one of my only experiences with shortwave radio was a few months ago when I got my SDR dongle and I was experimenting with Skywave Linux, and so I got onto some shortwave frequencies, and I was listening to number stations, and I've never had heard of it, and it was something that piqued my interest, and I wasn't expecting to find one. And within 20 minutes, I heard a number station coming out of Russia, you know, and you know, sending out those secret messages to the Russian operatives. It was interesting, you know. And never, it's all in the open air, but you know, and it's totally you know, a one time. You know, I forget what the phrase is, where you're it's a one time coded message that can only be decoded by the person on the other side, and they use it one time and never use it again. And it's you know, they call it number stations. Have you ever come across that?
I have, but you know, you can't listen to them all that long.
No, you can't. Oh. No, you can't. It's just one of those things that fascinated me for 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's about how long it takes. And then I think reading about them is far more interesting than listening to them.
Oh, definitely.
Because they are a peculiar animal. But, you know, when you zoom around the dials on shortwave, eventually you're going to hear, you know, people talking as if they have masks over their mouths. And you're going to hear these dots and dashes, dits and dahs, and wonder what that is.
Yeah.
And eventually, you know, there are some amateurs that broadcast in AM. And they you know, they sit back there and they have these hour and 5 hour long chats on AM using up all the power in the neighborhood. But, you know, when you can hear them and then you hear the guys on single sideband, I was asking my father, what is this? Why can't you hear some of these people? What are these dots and dashes? I want to know more about this.
Yeah.
So what's your living in Brooklyn? And my father signed me up for courses at the Hall of Science in Flushing Meadows Park. And he drove me over there for lessons in radio theory when I was 13.
13. Wow.
I had several out-of-body experiences sitting there with this guy talking about things I didn't understand. All I wanted to know was what the dits and dahs meant and how I could make my own dits and dahs.
Exactly.
But I knew enough, apparently, so I got my novice license, and that was my introduction to the world of amateur radio.
Yeah, one of the things that I sort of tell my students is when they're trying to study for the test is you know, a lot of that's going to be really confusing at first. It's going to be over your head, but the longer you stick with it, and when it gets difficult to push through it, then all of a sudden, once you start getting a little farther along in your study, then things start to make a little bit more sense, and that's when it's time to take the test. And once you're, you know, passing all the practice tests and everything like that,
yeah, before you know it, there's metacognition. You see the whole picture.
Exactly.
Instead of this crazy thing that you have to understand formulas and all this, you see the radio's frequencies in the same continuum as where light is, where x-rays are, where subsonic sounds are, where the human voice is, and you realize that it's all part of the same continuum.
Yeah, exactly. And so being involved with amateur radio, what's your favorite band to be on?
Oh boy, what a juicy question.
that's my goal, is to have the juicy questions.
Okay, well, the all-round best possible band for all possible purposes is 40 meters. That's 7.185, say 7.2 megahertz.
And why would you say that?
Because it's available 24 hours a day, and you can get surprisingly long distance communications on there. That is the neighborhood that used to be 7.200 to 7.500 was the old 41 meter band, which was used by shortwave stations. The last one to leave was 7.300 megahertz, was radio, Russian Radio International, which was the grandson of the old Radio Moscow.
Okay.
But so they, you know, it was the shortwave station broadcasters used it because it had a reliable signal in the evening hours when most people were awake and listening to the radio. But that said, my all-time favorite band is 30 meters, which is 10 megahertz. because it's CW only.
Oh, gotcha.
And that you can get worldwide communications on that pretty much any time of day or night because it's close enough. The real magic bands for distance are between 7 and 14 megahertz.
Right.
So when you're in there at 10 and nobody is bothering you with voice, and all it is digital and CW modes. It's just a fabulous little place to be.
And for those who are listening that aren't amateur radio operators, CW means continuous wave. That's Morse code. So, what countries have you talked to using Morse code?
Over 100.
So
everywhere from South Africa to Greenland, which isn't a country yet, but probably will be in the next 10 years.
So you're a big fan of talking to people all over the world then?
Yep. The one place I haven't gotten to, but I'd like to get to, is North Korea.
Yeah, and they don't allow that. Do they allow it?
They do allow it for de-expeditions. That is, if you get a tourist visa and go to North Korea and set up a station and you have somebody watching you, then you can broadcast out.
Gotcha. And I'm sure you're limited to what you can broadcast.
It's very rare. But I've contacted people on the St. Peter and Paul rocks in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. I've contacted Ascension Island. I've contacted Outer Mongolia.
Antarctica at all?
I've contacted Antarctica. I've contacted the space station.
Awesome.
I've contacted, the tiny little countries, San Marino, Liechtenstein, just about any place, Japan,
that's
China.
That's impressive. That's a long list of countries there. And one of the things that we're going to talk about, we have a few tech topics we're going to get into in a few minutes, but this topic that we're getting into is something that I was interested in hearing about. Emmett brought this up to me about 2 months ago when he was a special guest speaker on this topic, and it does seem to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a lot of different topics here. So Emmett is pretty passionate about talking about chestnut trees, and so if you are in the at least in the northeast area, you probably have never seen a chestnut tree, and maybe even the country. I'll let Emmett go ahead and talk a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, this is this obviously has is this is something that's been near and dear to my heart all my life, because all of us have favorite trees, you know. And when I was growing up, I had favorite elm trees, and I would watch them disappear because of Dutch elm disease. And I was looking in years ago to what was being done about American chestnuts, which was probably the greatest single environmental disaster in eastern North America since the landing of Columbus in 1492, which was a true ecological disaster. But we had about 1896 to maybe 1900, there was some people brought over chestnut trees from China or Japan. And of course, in their native habitat, those decorative 15-foot tall chestnut trees, which are really just orchard trees, those trees have an immunity to a blight, which is Cryphonectria parasitica.
Okay.
Is the name of the parasite. And it's an airborne fungus that blows around with the wind. And it didn't bother those trees over there. But when somebody brought that tree over here, like what happened with the Native Americans when the Europeans came over and started coughing up their yellow fever and their measles and hepatitis and all the other diseases that were brought here, to which Native Americans had zero resistance, the same thing happened to the chestnut. But the chestnut had absolutely no resistance. There is not a chestnut tree in North America that is not susceptible to Cryphonectria parasitica. So in a short period of time after 1904, when in the Bronx Botanic Garden in New York City, they discovered that their whole grove of 300-year-old chestnut trees had died within one season, they thought there was, you know, maybe a parasite. It took them a couple of years to realize that it was an airborne fungus, and there was nothing they could do about it. Really? And you can look for newspaper articles from 1912 and 1930 and 1940 talking about how it's inconceivable that we're going, but it looks like we're going to lose the chestnut tree. So how could this possibly be?
So the chestnut trees, they were planted and they survived for 300 years. And then all of a sudden this parasite came and wiped them all out.
Well, they, in parts of Appalachia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, they made up one out of every four trees.
Wow.
There were entire hillsides that turned white in June because of the flowers on the calyxes of the chestnut tree.
Gotcha.
The amount of food that was created, which is called the mast, M-A-S-T, the mast that was created by this enormous amount of food that was there in the forest was 80% of what the animals in the forest ate, which is an inconceivable number. If we were to propose that we're going to take 80% of the forest food out of the forest, what do you think would happen to the wildlife in that forest? It would certainly, it would never be the same. You would never have the same numbers. So we have a decline in virtually all kinds of mammals that survive on forest food. A lot of them who've moved into your backyard, such as squirrels that used to be forest animals. They're now backyard animals.
And you were saying that
that's where the food is.
And you were saying that this problem does not exist in Europe. Is that correct?
Right. There are two kinds of, well, there's more than two kinds, but the European chestnut is Castanea sativa, the sweet chestnut, and that appears to have hypovirulence. That is, the soil in Europe seems to be amenable to the growth of an organism that is able to overcome the blight. It kind of grows like a scab over it, and the tree is able to go on surviving. So you can look in Belgium, I know, in the Royal Forest in Belgium, there are some 500-year-old chestnuts that are still producing chestnuts. Every now and then, they'll fall, you know, they lose their hypovirulence, but it seems like something that if we could have it here would be a boon to, you know, regrowing our chestnut forests, which don't exist anymore.
So that's what I was going to ask you we were sort of talking earlier that, 100 years from now, this could be a real big issue where our whole full forest could be completely wiped out and hillsides right. can turn to dust and all that type of thing. What are they working on now? Is there any sort of technologies involved with alleviating this problem?
Well, fortunately, we have, before the authorities in the United States, we have presented a bioengineered chestnut, which simply is when you look at what other living things are susceptible to Cryphonectria parasitica, you find red oak trees, American wheat, and wild strawberries. They both are susceptible, but they both have an enzyme in them to overcome it. It's an ability to neutralize oxalic acid.
Okay.
And so if you take the gene in American wheat or strawberries that is responsible for neutralizing oxalic acid and you introduce it into a chestnut, then the chestnut does not lose any of its characteristics, which it does if you're trying to backcross it with classic Mendelian biology.
So there's hope, you know, anyway. There's hope.
There is. Well, we've actually come up with 15,000 chestnut trees that are blight resistant.
Oh, wow.
And these are 99.9997% American chestnuts.
Wow.
Yes. So, and it looks like we're going to get approval for those. Those are going to, when those are crossbred with the existing American chestnuts, that people can grow from nuts that they find on trees that haven't yet been destroyed by the blight, these trees will produce 50% of the nuts will be blight resistant. So it looks like we have a way forward on those.
That's great. Do you know what that reminds me of? Is a while back, I sort of did some research on, have you ever heard of Ecosia before?
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Well, apparently Ecosia is a search engine similar to Google or Bing. But what they do with every search that you do on their search engine, they basically take a tree and they plant it somewhere. So anytime you'll actually have a little counter on your screen, that every time you do a search engine, it'll say how many trees that you've planted. And a little bit of that money, that advertising money goes into planting trees. I remember they were in an island somewhere in Africa, and I can't remember the name of the island, but completely wiped out. There was no trees on the island anymore. They've gone in and planted 2 million trees at one point in time. Just a cool project that, I guess along the same similar lines as reforestation and that type of thing. So I checked it out a long time ago. It seemed like an interesting topic, and I don't know, I doubt that every single time you do a search you get a tree planted, but just the thought of that, I wonder if there's a way to get the chestnut tree involved with some of their programs or something.
I'd be surprised if someone hasn't already seen to it, but that's an idea. I'll bring that up.
Yeah,
with the group.
So
because there's a lot of fights ahead. I mean, we've got to bring the American elm back. There are threats to the oak tree. California is losing many of the towering oaks that stand along the Pacific shoreline. Something called sudden oak death is killing those. We have now white oak trees are now considered endangered in the eastern United States, which stuns me. We're losing hemlock trees. Anyone who's been down through New Jersey can see that entire watersheds are devoid of live hemlock trees. We're looking at the elimination of the white ash from the forests of the Northeast because of the emerald ash borer. We are looking at crown loss in sugar maples. It's not a question of if, but a question of when. Every single tree of any value in the Northeast and, the eastern United States is going to be threatened with destruction because there is a pathogen waiting somewhere in Asia that's going to kill virtually every tree we have, either with an insect or a fungus or some other kind of blight.
Are you, I'm sure you're familiar with the term old growth forests.
Yep.
So, in our area, for those of you who don't know, in upstate New York in the mountains area, much of the area was used for logging all over the region. And we had very many old growth forests, ginormous trees that were 150 to 200 years or maybe even more. And those old growth forests are now gone for the most part. And in very limited areas, you still find those old growth trees. So, It's a big problem all around. Things were wiped out and clear cut for so many years, that things are, hopefully will rebound, but these all these different problems that you just spoke of are real issues, and they could very easily wipe out a whole area.
Well, and the thing is, you look at a forest, and we're looking at trees with a diameter of 18 to 24 inches. And we think something that has a diameter of 24 inches is a mature tree. It is not a mature tree. If anyone who's seen a mature red oak or a mature American chestnut or even a mature birch tree, they can get, oaks and chestnuts can get diameters of 8 to 12 feet.
Wow.
That's up to 3 meters.
I guess I never put that together. That's impressive.
Yeah. And that's a diameter. I'm not talking about a circumference. The amount of board feet of usable wood that you can get from a chestnut is astonishing. The fact that it would last better, it lasts better in water than pressure treated pine does. It was used for making barns because it doesn't rot easily. It's just, we lose so much when we lose large trees. It's also the feeling that you get when you walk down a street and it has big trees with large diameters, there's nothing that compares to the feeling that you absolutely can't describe when you're walking down a street lined with such trees, and the emptiness, the blankness you feel when you're walking down a street devoid of such trees.
You know, I think that's a real good point. You know, when I visit, you know, New York City, and I will, you know, I know you're from the Bronx, right, Renjali?
Brooklyn.
You know, when you walk down the city and it's that skyscraper canyon, and you know, there's no grass and there's no trees, and you know, I just feel, you know, like blah after doing that. And it's nice to visit, but you know, I'd rather see those you know, walk down the street and see those trees, like you're saying. That's It's just a completely different feeling. You're right.
Yeah, it does something for you that you can't describe.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that topic up, because I was really interested in that. And, you know, speaking of no matter where you go, you get these feelings, you know, that you're, no matter where you go, you get the positive feelings, negative feelings, or the feelings that you might be being watched. Let's get into some tech topics trying to practice my segues here. Yeah, right. So we're getting into the tech topics this week. We just have a couple of real quick news articles. A headline that I came across earlier this week: the NSA triples metadata collection numbers, sucking up over 500 million calls in 2017. So that was up from 151 million in 2016 to 534 million in 2017. And this is sort of an interesting topic from time to time to sort of realize, you know, many people don't know that their data is being collected. I mean, we just had the Cambridge Analytica deal on Facebook. We had all these data leaks that happen year after year after year. But even in the whole time, you know, our data is being processed and analyzed and obviously looking for those bad characters that are out there. But in a minute of most people just being completely oblivious to the fact that all their data is collected, and is more and more of that data is being collected year after year. I was curious what your thoughts were on some of that.
Well, I think all of that data is probably people trying to call the White House, because I have tried to call the White House probably once a week for the past year and a half, and I've never gotten through. So that's what all this metadata is. They're recording all those calls. Must be.
I'm sure.
Yeah, but I'm curious to see if this is all telephones or if this is just cell phones.
Yeah,
because cell phones, as you know, are radio transmitters, and privacy on a cell phone is not insured. That's one of the little fine points that you get.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, anyone, it does transmit on a radio frequency. It's 930 to 960 megahertz. And there's a protocol that it's when you make a cell phone call, it's a little handshake that your phone does with another one via the cell tower that says we're going to agree on switching frequencies in the following order. But you can easily crack that code and emulate the algorithm. But you need to have a court order to listen to a wired telephone conversation. So you're actually, if you want privacy, you need to have a wired phone.
Really?
Yeah,
I haven't heard that. So that's kind of interesting. The differences. I'm sure there's fine print somewhere where they have.
you can't wiretap a wireless phone.
That's very true. You're right on task there. So I guess, you know, being more along those lines of you know, protecting your data. You know, one of the biggest, you know, companies out there that has been sort of being the advocate for, so to speak, advocate for people's privacy, Apple has been always that voice that's screaming loud at whenever somebody wants their records from an iPhone or an iPad. Apple has always in the past, you know, been on the user side, so to speak, at least in the public image. I saw an update this week that in Apple's iOS 11.4, there's going to be an update that basically will restrict the USB mode in iOS devices if you haven't used it in more than a week. So basically, it's a feature called USB restricted mode. It's just designed to defeat the physical data access by third parties like forensics programs like Grayshift and Celebrate and all those different things. I think it's a sort of a way to combat this ongoing battle with the FBI to be able to access user data without having a PIN or a pass key, so to speak, and it sort of blocks the lightning port of the device if it's been untouched for 7 days. So it gives law enforcement 7 days to get into that device if they can, but after that it will be restricted from forensic specialists. So I don't really know how I feel about that, to be honest. I know I gave you the article. What do you think about this whole deal with privacy data on iPhones and having physical access to it?
Well, I think we've been conditioned to think of privacy with the wrong set of glasses on. We used to think of privacy as something sacred, and now we think of privacy and we think of somebody trying to hide their pornography, or somebody wants to hide their terrorist activities or their nefarious plans. That's what privacy means now. And I think we need to clean our lenses and realize that for the vast majority of us, privacy means I don't want you to know what I'm thinking.
Exactly.
Because I have a right to be left alone.
Now, one of those
There were always acts of violence. In 1933 in New York City, 35 police officers were murdered out of a force of about 10,000. It's inconceivable that imagine if the government back then wanted to get a hold of all of the, surely these criminals in the liquor gangs must be communicating by telephone. Let's just tap all the telephones.
Right.
No, nobody thought that. Nobody proposed that.
Not at all.
We still looked at privacy as belonging to the people, not something that we fear because a small bunch of malcontents exploit it.
Now, did you know a lot of people have the misconception that if your phone is got a passcode on it and you're pulled over, that a police officer is not allowed to access your device. And that's actually incorrect for where we are, because anywhere within 100 miles of the border, law enforcement has the right to seize and access cellular devices. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
It's a really interesting thing I came across a few months ago. Anywhere within the 100 miles of the border, it's considered national security. And so law enforcement and, border patrol and those types of things, they can have access to those devices. They can confiscate the device and require you to provide access to those things. Even if you're not breaking the law, if they feel the need to, they can, because it's an issue of national security, which I was fascinated when I learned that the 100-mile border limit, because that goes, from where we are, that's almost 2 hours from here.
Well, it's like a famous American said, if you're willing to give up your liberty for a little bit of safety, then you don't deserve it.
Is that Benjamin Franklin? I think that's Franklin, isn't it?
I'm not sure. That's why I said a certain.
I think that was Benjamin Franklin.
I know that all the things that Lincoln said about the internet are probably not true.
Well, here's my thoughts on the whole iOS, the restricted USB mode. Let's say I'm doing nothing wrong. I'm not doing anything illegal. I have my own private data on my phone, and then something happens to me, whether I'm kidnapped or go missing or something like that, and they need to try to find out was there anybody close by, you know, was I in communication with anybody? Was I trying to sell something to somebody? And if that 7-day time period, you know, expires and they can't have, you know, or they don't have access to the phone or device yet. And that could be something that, you know, saves me from something, you know, that's a strange situation, you know, and we're looking at, you know, like you said, the drug dealers or the terrorists and we're not thinking everyday people too. So it's a, you know, I don't know how I feel about that. You know, I don't want people going through my devices, you know, but at the same time.
No, but I'll tell you, you know, the last people who are going to figure out how to do that is any agency affiliated with the government. Because if the government can figure out how to get into your phone, you better believe organized crime has gotten there well before they did.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, and you know,
I mean, there are places like Amazon. Could you imagine working for them? Because if there is a full-scale data breach at Amazon, the Americans' worldwide confidence in financial transactions over the internet are going to be damaged. People are not going to feel comfortable putting their data out there if they feel like it's susceptible. What they don't know is that it already is.
Yeah, and you know, that's what scares me is most people they seem to not care when their data is stolen, even if it's online. We have right, the target,
because we get so much for free, we really don't care.
Yeah, the Target breach, you know, when Target had their data breach a couple years ago, I stopped using my credit card at Target, you know, whenever right. I could. Now, this was before Apple Pay, but I stopped using my credit card there. And now with Apple Pay, it's just the token system. So your credit card numbers aren't being shared. So I try to use Apple Pay whenever I can there. But you know, it's just one of those things.
Me, I'm finding new uses for cash.
Yeah, you know, I think I've been thinking more and more about that too myself. And
yeah, somebody else's signature is on it.
Yeah, exactly. of course, there's the Bitcoin thing too, but we're not allowed to do Bitcoin where we are anymore. So they banned Bitcoin in Plattsburgh.
Well, that's a bunch of nonsense. Yeah. I'm afraid that I think that's dangerous.
Yeah, I see that.
Because like I said, you know, if it's smart, government is the last one that's going to get there. So who thought of Bitcoin? It certainly wasn't the government. It sounds like an ideal vehicle for organized crime.
I agree with you there. And, you know, I guess we'll see where this goes over the next few months with you know, well, the whole NSA thing. I think they said that the funny thing is with the NSA topic is that they always blame Snowden for these figures. Well, we were collecting more data, but then Snowden came out and it sort of went down for a few years. But we recovered. We went back up. So I don't think that's true at all. I think they're always trying to make him a scapegoat on you know, the sort of revelations that he came out with a couple years ago. And you know, I think we're just going to see that data tracking more and more, even with Google and Microsoft and Apple. I think they all track to some extent, and it's just going to keep getting worse, I think, until something happens.
What gets me, I mean, we're both in a school environment, and I remember 20 years ago when there was an outfit called this guy, Whipple Communications, WHIPPLE, and they had this product called Channel One, and they were willing to wire every school in America with cable so that we had access to cable television, which was kind of, oh, wow, that's neat. What we had to do was have the kids sit through a couple of minutes of advertisements every hour of programming that was given to the television, to the school district. And it never succeeded because teachers and administrators, parents, and every stakeholder threw up their hands and said, advertisements? Children, you're making them sit through. This is, it was an outcry. Whipple Communications went out of business by, I think, 2001.
Wow.
And now you might have an ad blocker, but that doesn't matter because half the sites you go to now tell you, please turn off your ad blocker exactly. To access this content. And kids are bombarded with advertising.
There's ads everywhere. And
they get them in email. I mean, most of your email is advertising. They're bombarded with advertising on every news site they go to, every research site they go to. They don't know how to interpret the search results that they get because that is also advertising. And it seems we accept that because we get so much for free. Well, look at how much liberty we've given up.
Exactly. You know, and even with the Child Protection Acts that have been put out, I mean, there's still...
What a bunch of nonsense that is.
Yeah, exactly. And they're still... they still are, susceptible to a wide range of things, even being under 13. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
Well, all right. I think we're going to wrap things up here. I definitely appreciate you coming on the show, being the first guest. I thought you would be a great guest.
Well, exciting.
We've had a good time talking to you here. A lot of great different things. So
there are so many different aspects. I'm sure to bore somebody.
I'm sure we'll hear a lot of feedback on a lot of the topics we talked about tonight. So I'm hoping that we'll get some feedback. So if you want to provide some feedback to the show, just go to mrptechreviews.com, hit the contact form there, which is working now. It wasn't for a while. You could also email me mrptechreviews@gmail.com. We have an RSS feed. You can subscribe to the podcast. That'll be in the show notes, along with all the links that we talked about tonight, everything we talked about. Thanks again to Emmett for coming on the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next time.